adjective can go a long ways to describing a phenomenon. It's other words that have been used for similar effects. You may have heard words like cosmic shear, which I think is not as common a word in most people's vocabulary. It's not fundamentally different, but it's a way of talking about Gaussianity in large scale structure and elsewhere. And in particular, there is a limit that what I call the tidal limit is often also called a squeezed limit when you have, you know, a separation of scales that happens. And I'll explain a bit about it and how I think this has some very unique cosmological applications of allowing you to measure cosmological parameters that are relatively clean. And I'll explain a bit of what I think we can do with this effect, which actually is large and I think underappreciated. It is not like totally new. I mean, you know, this is a 3-4 point statistic that in various guises has been looked at before. So let me start off with just the standard thing of tides and how I like to view this, the concept of a squeezed limit, and take it from there. Tides, I think everybody here is familiar with tides. Pedagogically, I've always thought that the way I like to think about the tide is in terms of a residual force, just like, you know, we learn in general relativity. It's a local, the only local effect in a free-falling frame that you can measure, which I think is something that is very poorly explained at school. When I was in school, they used to tell us that if you're sitting on Earth, you've got a moon pulling on one side, that, you know, water falls towards the moon. Of course, that would predict presumably a dipolar pattern of tides, which is not observed. And when you raise your arm, at least when the high school I went to, they asked, why do you get two tides a day if the water's falling towards the moon? He says, well, you know, on the backside of the Earth, you have the Earth and the moon pulling on the water, which of course is nonsense. It's of course because we're in a free falling, and in a free falling system, there is no dipole, and all you have left is the tide. So fortunately, nowadays we have Wikipedia, so you don't have to believe your high school teacher anymore. You can look it up yourself, and we all know that if you have in the free falling frame of the Earth, if you have a moon sitting on the right, you get the residual distortion remaining is a quadrupole distortion that pulls the water towards the moon on one side, and just by being in the rest frame, the leading order expansion has to lead to an equal and opposite anti-bulge on the other side. We could call, you know, we can try to explain, we can call it the centrifugal force acting on the other side, because of course in the co-ordinating system, things go, things, you know, get accelerated in the opposite direction. This is all, you know, a very complicated way of just saying that around a minimum, you can expand everything as a polynomial, and the second order polynomial just has, you know, two directions and you're done. So mathematically, this is pretty straightforward. In detail, of course, this can be a bit of, you know, work of actually mapping what each term corresponds to. So maybe there is no easy high school procedure to explain what a tide is. I don't know. But the important thing to note is that this is what I call, what's often called a squeezed limit residual. Right? What you do is you have a small scale, let's say the size of the Earth, on which you're measuring the gravitational residual coming from a point far away compared to the size of my measurement, like the Earth. The Moon is a light second away. The Earth is, you know, a few percent, 2% of that distance. So you've got a nice separation of scales. And when the separation of scales is nice and the perturbation is small, then this expansion is very accurate. And really all you really see is a quadrupole, and that's a really good approximation. The higher order effects are very small. So the two tides are really almost the same in a day. Well, the fact that they differ usually comes because you've got tides from the sun, but that's a different story. But just in the system, this becomes a very clean separation of scales, and that's often also called a squeezed limit these days. So when we talk about the effects of a large scale on a small scale, we can treat the residual effect of the large scale as what we call squeezing. Squeezing just means you have one scale which is large and one scale which is small, as far as this is concerned. And that makes the calculation very clean. It doesn't, at that point, it doesn't actually matter anymore how far away this large scale is. In particular, the sun and the moon have a comparable tidal effect on Earth, well, within a factor of maybe 3, certainly. And it didn't actually matter how far away they are. They're both bottom polar. They're all really, really the same thing. So the squeezedness, the good thing is it doesn't depend on details of the far away thing. The bad thing, of course, is if you wanted to use a tide to measure distance to the moon, that's not going to happen. You know, it's independent of such things. So this is just a short summary of what we mean by tides, what we mean by squeezing. So let's look at the universe as a whole. By the way, this is, of course, a purely gravitational effect that everybody knows. And this is another picture, n-body simulation, from my student, Yuval Shim, who is not credited, I'm afraid. But yes, so this is, you know, you've all seen these pictures of the dark matter density in some cosmological volume, where, of course, you know, you see filaments, you see, it's often called the cosmic web. And you know, it's web is descriptive. I suppose it has a web-like structure. However, it's only descriptive if it contains no physics. The word web, in this context, okay, there's nothing web. There's nothing producing a web. However, I think the better physical description for this is the remains of a cosmic tidal field. And if you think about what are we looking at? What we're looking at is, you see, for example, is popularly called a filament of large-scale structure, like here. Well, what is that? Well, that's an extreme remnant of a tidal force on this piece of dark matter. What you can see is that this dark matter gravitationally got squeezed in this direction and not so squeezed in the other direction. So you get a quadrupolar distortion on its shape. Okay, and this effect is large. It's not a small subtle effect. It is huge. You know, this is hugely tidally. All the large scale structure that we're looking at is hugely tidally distorted. It's also displaced, of course. You know, the mean center of mass of this filament, who knows where it came from? It came from somewhere. I mean, in simulation, you can go back and figure out where it came from. But that is not easily measured. Okay, if you look at what's observable, the distortion is completely, it's a huge effect. You know, you don't need some precision measurement to see that it's distorted. The displacement is clearly not directly observable.
So what do you mean by distortion? Distortion with respect to what?
To being round.
Round, okay, that's what you mean.
Yes, so most things don't look very round, so there's an order unity non-roundness in this. So with other words, displacements are generically not observable, and tides are very prominent. That's the generic outcome of gravitational structure formation and gravitational instability. Okay, well, now you can ask the question, well, since we have such a prominent, in fact, this is a simulation, of course, in real galaxy surveys, it looks qualitatively like this as well, and there are prominent, you know, filaments, prominent alignments, and we've just said, well, these are just the consequences of tidal forces on free-falling particles, which is why they are, you know, highly squeezed. Now, this is a literal use of the word squeeze, not related to my physics word squeeze. They look elongated. And of course, we know that if you can measure the tidal field everywhere, there exists a linear transformation to measure any other parameterization of the gravitational potential. You can use that to measure the gravitational potential, you can measure velocity. All linear quantities are linearly related. So in fact, by looking at this, by just noting which way the tidal tensors are aligned, you have an overdetermined system from which you can precisely reconstruct the gravitational potential field. Okay, and that is a process I want to call cosmic tides. There are related phenomena to cosmic tides. For example, there is a relatively fashionable topic in recent years has been the gravitational lensing. Okay, and the effect is the same. The effect is that apparently isotropic objects appear anisotropic. It's called shearing. you could call it tidal distortion as well, except that that effect is very small. So gravitational lensing, because of various geometric factors, tends to be of order, you know, typically percent to a few percent, depending on what you're lensing. On the microwave background, it's up to 10%. Shearing, meaning the statistical induced anisotropy, is a small effect. It's painful to measure. You need a, you know, a very high quality survey. You have to overcome a huge number of systematics. It's a very challenging endeavor that has, however, been very successful. We have made, you know, quite impressive dark matter mass measurements by the same effect from lensing, which is the same thing. You measure the tidal distortion due to the intervening gravity. Note that, well, that's an expensive way of doing it, right? Because here you have order unity distortion instead of a 1% distortion. So this is 100 times easier than gravitational lensing. Much easier. Effect is large. You don't have to worry about point spread functions, these filaments, you know, arc minutes across. You know, this is, on this grand scheme of things, trivial compared to the much, much harder exercise people have done of reconstructing the intervening apparent distortion. This is a real distortion, much bigger than the apparent one that we usually go after. Okay. So this is mathematically identical to gravitational lensing. Observationally, orders of magnitude easier, and it contains the same type of information. It contains the distribution of dark matter, or rather its potential. And of course, here we measure it in three dimensions instead of two, and therefore this contains, you know, many orders of magnitude more information than lensing would ever give you. Okay, so this is a quick way of mapping the universe without having to do very complicated things. I think I just said that. It's like lensing. And of course, the lensing in the case you distort, for example, in the case of this large-scale structure, there are two modes in which people use gravitational lensing. One is to look at individual galaxies, like the CFHT lensing survey. Another one is to lens a microwave background, like it's been done in WMAP by Smith et al. And others. Or in Planck, I speculate we will hear about it in the next few months of how well Planck did on its lensing. There are probably people in the room who actually know the answer already. I don't. And that's perfectly well understood of how you do this linear transformation. Okay, if you lens a Gaussian random field, you have to build a quadratic estimator so the lensing potential is quadratic in the background field. If the source field is non-Gaussian, this procedure is still well understood, at least in the limit in the subset of having quadratic estimators, understood for any form of lensing fields. It's a well understood, optimal procedure. It is, I think, a simpler description of a lot of non-Gaussian effects that have been talked about, especially late time non-Gaussian effects. As an example, there has been a lot of debate about a squeezed statistic called FNL. Okay? FNL is identical to this. Okay? You look at the effect on the small scale by a large scale mode. And so these map onto each other. And in fact, a very nice paper by Criminelli et al. Shows how, you know, if you want to ask a simple question, obviously there's primordial FNL, which is what is of a lot of cosmological interest. But there's also the mundane FNL that's induced just by normal cosmological evolution. And Criminelli, of course, I think had a very nice paper calculating what this FNL actually looks like from this late-time evolution. And that is, the same as meaning an exaggeration, but an analogous effect that Criminelli points out. He points out that, in fact, the dominant effect is the quadrupolar distortion. Okay, so normal FNL we talk about is a monopolar distortion. We take a triangle of modes with one short mode, and we ignore the angle between the long and the short vector, saying that a vector going to zero, why do you care about the angle of zero? Criminelli shows that the angle is an angle dependent on this limit, and that's an order of magnitude bigger than the monopole effect. The very nice paper here showing that actually it's the tidal one is the dominant effect in all of these, and that normally by ignoring it, one has thrown away most of the information. So in practice, I think he indirectly pointed to the fact that the squeezedness is dominated by the quadrupole and not by the monopole. So the normal things we've been looking for are a very incomplete description of an equally simple effect, but it's quadrupolar. Just a quick review of how this quadratic, the traditional context has been lensing reconstruction works. I'm going to call it general tidal reconstruction here. It's the same. And just to recall, what we want is to estimate the gravitational potential or density, which is, in this case I'm going to call the same thing. It's just a linear transformation. And that, we say, will depend, so there are really two density fields. One is the one you measure, I'm going to call that delta G, as being a reference at some galaxy density field that I can observe. And the delta I'm going to call the dark matter density field I'm trying to reconstruct from something I've measured. In the case of CMB, this delta G would be the temperature of the CMB, and this delta would be the dark matter between us and the CMB. It's the same procedure. And what happens is that this thing is some quadratic function of the field you observe. So it's a linear function in the dark matter potential. It's a quadratic function on the background. And that allows you to calculate, of course, leads to a three-point correlation between dark matter and background. For example, in Smith et al., they actually measure the three-point function of delta dark matter with delta CMB, delta CMB. So that's explicitly done. It turns out to actually be computationally fairly straightforward up to optimality. So if you want to be truly optimal, if you want to do a little bit more work, especially if survey is complicated, noise matrices, it can be computationally rather involved. But the procedure is very simple. You measure a density field, delta. I apologize, I should have a subscript. Well, okay, I mean, we've got inconsistent notations here. But you measure something, you convolve it by a window. And this window, in the simplest case, is just a Gaussian. In the optimal case, it's a Wiener-like filter. And then you take the gradient of this smooth quantity and take the outer product of the gradient. And then there exists some optimal kernel mapping to a linear mapping. You go from there to the dark matter potential. Okay, that is the all lensing reconstructions for Gaussian fields like CMB lensing are done this way. And the only trick is that this window, the optimal is not Gaussian, the optimal one is a Wiener-like filter. But it's still some function. Okay, then this is all we ever do. Often it's described in different ways. You know, the language used is often one of deflection angles. As I say, I personally think that is not a very good pedagogical description. I mean, they're all the same. But I personally like to, you know, make a little bit of a point that deflection is not observable because you don't know where things, you know, anisotropy is observable, deflection is not. Rotating the sky by a whole sky by 10 degrees, that clearly has no effect on any intrinsic observable. So calling the tide, so shear and convergence are observables. Those are actually physical observables, and that's what one really should be describing these. But they're all the same, okay? This is nothing new, this is just a more general way of. Yes?
Here, I guess you want to replace a simple bias prescription with something that is slightly more realistic. So if it was actually, I mean, the simple bias thing is this Kij is, I guess, just trying to see, Kij is just one over Laplace or inverse Laplacian or something like that. If it was just simple bias, the linear bias prescription that everybody uses. But then the thing is that just there is no, I mean, in a sense, this is an ansatz that needs to be justified, that there is a linear relationship between, this is a linear relationship?
No, you're not that fancy, right? It's like saying if we do CMB lensing, okay, we don't, the lensing part doesn't assume very much about the CMB at all, except for a few things that it does assume, okay? It does not assume you know the amplitude. It's independent bias. You're saying if I multiply my temperature field by 2, my lensing map will not change. Okay, it's independent of bias in that sense. It's even independent of shape. Imagine that I've got a scale-dependent bias, and the CMB I observe doesn't even have the same slope as the CMB that I put in. That's fine, as long as the optimality, of course, the Wiener filter, does depend on the observed power, not on the theoretical power, just on the actually observed power spectrum. Okay, so you don't need to know why. You only need to know that it has a correlation.
But you agree that CMB lensing is a simpler process compared to, galaxy formation. Because CMB lensing, you just have a displacement field that has nothing to do with the CMB and just displaces the field CMB. But here you have a field which does depend on the galaxy distribution or on the initial matter distribution. So that's what you want to measure. So in a sense, that means the difference is that that's a linear process for the CMB lensing. This is a nonlinear process.
It's, well, quadratic process. So in the CMB, so you're saying that normally when we do CMB, we look at the CMB budget of 1,000. You've got a length and a budget of 1, let's say.
Yeah.
And then you say, because these two are decoupled, you make a quadratic function of the CMB, which is a linear function of the lensing field. So the, for example, in Smith et al, what you measure is you have another measurement of the intervening field. So you measure the three-point function of the lens source, right? That's what you reconstruct, and you say, well, that's simple in the sense that the source, the lens error terms are decorrelated.
Yeah.
That's what you're trying to say, which affects something at one level further than this. This affects the covariance of these things. If you're going to ask for the error, then yes, that does depend on such things. This estimator does not. Because the estimator does not depend on any of this. The error term does. So in the case of the Smith et al. Error, you say that the NVSS or that this screen has independent uncorrelated errors, making my error expression easier to understand. Okay, in that sense, yes. But I'm not going to get into errors here yet. Errors are yet another exercise. And again, I'm going to this is very technical, but this is, nice thing about it is it's a squeezed configuration. Meaning that you're going to use a small scale structure to look at large scale gravitational fields. And there, we actually understand those mode couplings reasonably well. Okay, and in fact, it turns out that this is a dominant coupling. This tidal coupling actually is the dominant coupling of the nonlinear mode coupling of errors. So I think this actually makes life easier for all of these questions. So if we do this to the simulation I just showed you, okay, to the simulation, and you get these quadratic shear estimators, just like in lensing, that doesn't look very profound. So anyways, you go in the lensing field, these gammas just are some funny looking field, but that's not all that interesting. More interesting is if you take the combination of the of these shears, as that, you know, there's a linear function you apply to it. So the first one was quadratic in the density, and this is linear in the shears, and you get in lensing, they're commonly called an E mode density map and a B mode density map, because you observe two things and you only have one underlying degree of freedom, and you rotate them to have what should be lensing like gravitation. Which comes from a potential term and something which is an odd parity map. Then you can ask, how well does that actually do? And we can ask, well, obviously, first of all, the signal to noise wise, you need obviously to average over a number of structures to reconstruct a larger scale shear. So here I've smoothed the same map on a larger scale. And this is the density we've reconstructed by this procedure. And that is the actual density in the simulation from which this was reconstructed. And you can see there certainly are at least correlations. Okay, so overdensities, the simulation do show up as overdensities in the reconstructed field, meaning that, it's not perfect. It's not a perfect correspondence, but we are able to reconstruct the actual large-scale density field through this tidal reconstructor. As would be surprising if it didn't happen, because if this didn't work, that would mean those filaments did not come from tidal forces, which in the simulation, that's all we have. It's a gravity-only simulation. Okay, so this is a empirical demonstration that all these, you might vary, it's nonlinear, who knows what. It doesn't actually matter so much that it's nonlinear. All that matters is that the tidal axes come from large scale tides. Here we go, they do. And here's a way of quantifying how you do. So this is the power spectrum of the so the black one is the dark matter power spectrum, the dashed one is the reconstructed power spectrum, and the dotted one is the cross power between the ingoing and outgoing. And you can see that certainly it's in on scales where linear gravity is expected to hold, which is usually like 0.1 and below, you get a good reconstruction, meaning that the reconstruction, the density field, not just has the same amplitude, which is not very profound. What's important is that actually point by point is the same. In other words, that the dotted line is close to the black and dashed lines. Okay, so means, you know, cross correlation coefficient is like 0.8, 0.9, meaning I've reconstructed the modes to 80 or 90% accuracy on linear scales empirically in a simulation. Yes.
And is the is the fact that the agreement was you know good but not perfect on the previous slide, is that saying that there the two things are kind of comparable or is it
comparable mean, well okay so I think there are two things of, but what do you mean by comparable? One is you say that that this is only, you know, there's still a difference of 10-20% between the reconstructed field and the field that went in. So, you know, there's noise in this reconstruction. It means, yes, there are things happening that are not just due to the long scale forces. I think that's part of it. Now, I think it's probably not correct to say that 90% of an object's shape is determined by large scale forces, because remember that over here we've averaged over many small scale shapes. Like in regular weak lensing, you know, the apparent shape of a galaxy, the intrinsic ellipticity is typically like 0.3, and you add 1% due to gravitational lensing. If you have enough of them, of course, I can still measure this thing very accurately. The actual noise, it's probably at least 50% from small scale self interactions that lead to tidal distortions. Yes.
So you're doing this with the dark matter simulation, right? So you actually haven't put galaxies in, have you?
In this simulation, there are no galaxies.
So, of course, a more direct way of getting the density field is just look at the density field, because you have
In this simulation, that is correct.
Yeah.
When you know the answer. But of course, you want to test this. You want to do something for which you know the answer before you go on.
But the challenge is if this works just as well for galaxies, then that would be...
Okay, good. We'll get there. We will get there in the next slide. So, real galaxies. This is now a map of the Sloan galaxy survey. And this is very real, not even simulated. These are the galaxies out in the in the real sky. This is the this is the best projection I could make. The Sloan survey is projected onto the North Galactic Pole. It covers, I don't know. Come on, someone, sky. Anyway, so this is at a redshift, median redshift, I think, of 0.1 that I made the slice. So it's a 300 megaparsecs distance. The physical scales are not that different from the simulation you saw. So it's kind of, you know, similar sized thing. The filaments here are not as prominent, and that's because the galaxy density at that median redshift is already starting to, well, a couple of things that contribute to it. Obviously, for the finite thickness to the slice that I've plotted. Also, it says that, you know, the sampling is not all that dense, even for the Sloan main sample. That, there are some filamentary structures you see, but not nearly as dramatic as in the simulation. That's because it's annoyed, you know, it's just poorly sampled. I think we do know that as you sample these things better, they do start filling these things in. and it's not clear that you actually really need to sample them all that well because they're self-noise, so this is probably not too far off. But anyway, this is it, okay? So real galaxies and a real universe on the sky.
And what is the amplitude? What is the amplitude of the Oort density? What's the contrast between the Oort and the density?
I don't have a color scale here, but I think typically it's of order a few. I mean, you can see that in order to make this smooth, you'd have, you know, it's the halfway between white and black that gives you the mean density, and these things are probably a factor of, I don't know, it's a few, three or four over dense when you look at on the scale. And that's basically the filling factor of the stuff. Because remember, this is a bit extreme because the black stuff, there just are no galaxies, so the real galaxy surveys come discrete. Either you've got an object or you don't, unlike in a simulation where it's a continuous function. So here, I mean, in that sense, the density here is exactly zero, like completely zero, because I've seen no galaxies, and here it's not zero. The ratio in that sense is infinite, but relative to the mean, this would be -1, and that might be like, you know, 3 or 4. And that's just, these are all, you know, what happens when you have real galaxies. This is, when you're counting objects, either you have them or you don't. Okay, we do the same thing again. We construct this tidal field. We construct it, and then we ask, okay, here, unfortunately, we have the drawback that I don't actually know the true gravitational potential, unlike in my simulation where I actually knew it. So all I can really ask is, when I do the same thing of smoothing the reconstruction on a large scale, does it look like my density field? One more step removed, because it is not guaranteed a priori that the galaxies on large scales trace the dark matter field on large scales. That's no, nobody promises you that to start with, even though most people think that is the case. So here, but here when we do the reconstruction, here's the reconstructed large-scale density field, and here is the galaxy large-scale density field, not the dark matter. I don't know what the dark matter actually looks like. Okay, this is my best guess as a dark matter, and that is a galaxy. And I don't know if you think they look similar. I think visually you can see some correlation even by eye between these two maps. And of course, you can measure the cross powers the same way. And you can see that indeed you do see they are highly correlated. This dotted line is again it's not as perfect as in the simulations, which had no noise and nothing else. But the whole thing does agree to within a factor of 2 at least, meaning that you do get at least a 50% reconstruction of the large scale modes. And the difference, again, it's with a single sample, you have to think a bit harder of how you get an error bar on this. You know, in simulation, I can just simulate it 10 times. Here, you'd have to think of, you know, what you would actually do. And that's a separate topic. I can give another 2 talks on how you would do the error bars on that. But certainly, you see that they are positively and substantially correlated to, you know, meaning 50% or so between those two. So I've reconstructed them to about 50% fidelity, meaning either I know my dark matter field is 50% or the galaxy field traces dark matter field is 50%. But at least those two things are not entirely unrelated. Okay, so I think this is arguing that this on real data, and also there are many other things that, and I just want to caveat on the subtleties of using real data compared to a simulation, that in a simulation, life is simple. You've got a periodic box, I know the Fourier transforms, I know how to do my Green's functions and kernels, and all these things are, you know, there are no issues. In an actual thing where there are gaps and the density coverage is non-uniform and you've got a weight and your noise is changing from pixel to pixel, you've got edges, all these things, again, in principle, there are analogies. In fact, not just in principle, in practice, we can write down, and some people have written down quadratic estimators on real density fields, like Kendrick, and for example, has done it for WMAP, has written down the real thing, it's a real pain, it's, I would say, a factor of 1,000 times, at least, well, let's say at least a factor of 100 times more work to actually do it optimally in a data set than to do it on a simulation. So I have not done that. I have just pretended it was a periodic box and put it in a box and treated it as if it were a simulation. This is highly non-optimal. So, you know, part of the discrepancy which just comes from the fact that I have not treated my boundaries. In fact, if you look at, you know, you can clearly see a big edge effect. The edge looks white. You know, that's clearly, I don't think there's extra dark matter there or anything. It's just my procedure. We'll take gradients along into the edge and do things to it.
Your kernel, I mean, that has to be also the optimal kernel that you have to use. That also will be dependent on
That's right. And of course, the optimal kernel is no longer a convolution. It's just a matrix.
Yeah, exactly.
So to do it correctly is a lot more work. And I'm lazy. I didn't do that work. So you know, I'm just saying this is just this quick and simple thing one can do just to demonstrate that at least even doing something, you know, if you wish, naive, at least gets you somewhere. Okay, there is a signal. Okay, it is worth somebody. I don't know if it's me or not, but somebody actually doing the optimal analysis on this exact same data set. You know, there's more, you can do better clearly. And this is not good. Yes?
In real data, how do you notice the original shear of the CNB map?
Of the galaxy map in this case? I don't. That's why I say, unlike in a simulation, I know what the answer is. Here, I don't know what the answer is.
If you want to apply it to the real, this is the reconstruction from the CNB.
From galaxies, from the Sloan Galaxy Survey. Yes, we construct the dark matter density map in the Sloan volume from the Sloan Galaxy filaments, basically. Okay, and I don't know the answer. Well, I am being lazy here because people, this redshift is not that optimal for certain other measurements. In principle, you can actually use lensing to map the dark matter distribution of Sloan. Turns out it's a little bit shallow to get, I'm saying this dark matter that I don't know is in principle knowable, right? If you, with the right data set, one might be able to just measure it. But Sloan is not the right data set in that sense. You know, we're not gonna, we'll probably never have an independent cross check on this particular data set. It's just that this data set happens to be publicly available. You can download it from the website and just try it. Whereas some other things, for example, the Sloan, the BOSS LRG survey is better matched in redshift range for other ways of getting some dark matter, but whatever. There's more that could be done. This is just a start to push into this concept, testing that yes, the tidal picture, even given all various nonlinear things on small scales that we don't know, can be parameterized as just a source of noise and do not entangle with each other in some complex way to stop you from doing this. Okay? And that's true for all lensing, by the way. Like even with normal galaxy shear lensing, you have to assume that the galaxies intrinsically don't have correlated alignments, which is not truly known from first principles. But empirically, it's true. So a lot of these things we do on an empirical basis that, it seems to work with data, even though there's not a first principles proof that it has to work. I think that's what Neeraj might be getting there as well. With CMB lensing, there is a difference. We understand the CMB perfectly from first principles. And then the lensing does not have these uncertainties. You have to make fewer assumptions going into a true CMB lens just because you understand the source statistics, almost perfectly. Here, the galaxies, or in any other lensing scenario, I think even with galaxy shear lensing, same problem. You don't know everything a priori. So certain things you just have to try to test point, point by point. Are they aligned? Well, I'm going to try to test it.
So, on that note, one difference between when you can use, quadratic estimator and when it's really suboptimal is like how big the effect is. And I think, quadratic estimator is near optimal if the effect is, if just basically the length is small. But then if it's, if they're small, we have to qualify it's a technical thing, exactly what you mean by small. But obviously here you have big effect because ellipticities are order one. So my guess would be that the quadratic estimator would be very suboptimal as opposed to something more nonlinear. Would you agree?
Well, kind of. I think it's more subtle than that. So what is true, that in the hypothetical case that you had strong lensing of the CMB. Now, in practice, this doesn't actually happen because the CMB doesn't tend to have structures on the scales where there is strong lensing. But at least you can have a thought experiment. Imagine it did, which it doesn't really, but imagine, or you had a very big strong lens, which we don't. But at least in that limit, okay, that's understood. In the limit that you did strong lensing of the CMB, where you have large anisotropies in the power spectrum, the shear per factor of 10 to 1, let's say, on the CMB power spectrum, it turns out that even then, the quadratic estimator is optimal, and that's just because the CMB is still Gaussian. Okay, it depends on the Gaussianity of the CMB. It does not assume Gaussianity of the lensing structures. Okay, so CMB lensing, it just says that all lensing does is it makes the normally isotropic and stationary CMB statistics into an anisotropic, but perhaps still stationary statistic. And an anisotropic Gaussian random field is still a Gaussian random field and still described by two-point statistics. Therefore, a quadratic function is still information filling.
Really, but I think it's a technical point to discuss. I don't think that's true, that just because it's Gaussian, you can use quadratic estimator. I don't think one follows from the other. So it's not just Gaussianity, it's also a gradient expansion that you have to make.
That gradient expansion, so that's a long topic. We can sit down in detail. In the end of Channel and Lewis, they do go through this, that in fact there was a paper by Kluber 2 years ago claiming that the gradient expansion misses certain terms. It turns out the gradient expansion is a bit of a red herring, that it does not have to hold. And in fact, that's why I think this local shear picture is a much more direct expansion. That, and they go through there as well, and they show that these two really are the same, that this gradient holding is irrelevant to the optimality of the whole construction, and that it stays, you know, that it really does stay optimal, and that these higher order L plus or minus bigger than one things people have debated are not actually, don't actually hold. It is really local, it is really optimal, and it really only depends on Gaussianity. So if you give up anisotropy but keep Gaussianity and stationarity, and the estimated are quadratic. That's provable. But that's very technical. I think that's a bit of a detail here as well. However, it is true, however, that in this case, you've got a bigger problem is that you're, unlike the CMB, which we know stays Gaussian under lensing, this is not Gaussian to start with. So there are a whole new set of issues. And I think each one of them can be discussed, addressed. Some of them we understand. And not all of them, obviously. There's still issues that are open. That I think there's lots of stuff that would be good to understand better if one wants to take this forward as a production technique. So yeah, I know there's a signal. It's yes.
So here you're comparing the power spectrum reconstructed from the tidal field from the galaxies with the power spectrum.
Yes.
So you hope then that if it's worth reconstructing the power spectrum from the tidal field from the galaxies, you're actually getting better. I mean, is there a bit of this where you feel you're doing better than the direct reconstruction, so to speak?
Well, I would say right now I'm not doing better. Okay, right now the reconstruction is at the 50% or maybe less even level. That is a noisy reconstruction, and this disagreement I interpret as being my reconstruction being noisy, not that the galaxies are stochastic on large scales. I'm not. You know, that would be the other interpretation, which I would not try to promote here. That at this stage, this is not the. You know, obviously you have the field, just measure it. You know, why do this complicated thing? So I think this is not at this point the final answer, or even a good use of the data. What I'll argue in a minute is that for the same reason that we do lensing at all, okay, we ask, why do we bother with lensing surveys? Because galaxy surveys measure it in 3D to much lower noise than any lensing survey ever even dreams to measure it. Okay, so why are we doing it? Well, there is a motivation of why people do this. It's because the lensing reconstruction is thought to be free of bias, for example. Okay, you don't have to know the amplitudes up from first, Anyways, they are, for the same reasons. So I think you don't have to have bigger signal to noise to make this exercise highly motivated, for the same reason that all lensing surveys have low signal to noise, and yet they are thought to be a more robust way of just measuring the dark matter without having to worry about scale-dependent bias, evolution of bias, or, all kinds of things. There are different camps. There are certain camps that say, well, lensing is a waste of time. We have much better galaxy data, so I think it depends on which side of the fence you sit on. You will have a different interpretation of whether this is worth pursuing.
A related question is if you did something funny to the dynamics, with some different growth rate or something, is it going to change the relationship between these two determinations? Because one is, the tidal thing does sort of have dynamics.
Yes, the tide integrates over the tidal history of the structure growth. It's not unlike lensing, which is instantaneous. This is integral over time. So yes, there are It is a different probe yet than Lensing, which is an instantaneous probe. This is an integrated probe of types, which again, for certain things, actually is a good. It can be a good thing depending on what you're trying to, depending on what you're trying to measure at the end of the day. Okay, so let me argue a few things that this might open up that might not be possible otherwise, which is. One amusing discussion has been how one does cosmology of any form ever. And so far, a large amount of the motivation of cosmological position cosmology has come from measuring a power spectrum, okay, of whatever, CMB, galaxies, and take your pick, dark matter. In fact, almost everything we know has come from that certain approach, a few exceptions, but the vast majority of position information we have comes from measuring a power spectrum. With the goal is not being knowing the power spectrum, but the goal is to know the underlying transfer function, okay? The underlying, growth of structure function. That's what we actually, what the theory predicts. We measure a power spectrum and we hope to infer from that the transfer function. That's our real goal. Now, this is intrinsically limited, often called cosmic variance limit, that if you have a finite number of modes, you can never measure your underlying expectation value to better than root n. So for example, in the CMB, there's debate of whether the quadrupole is low. Some people think, just as an example, that's something which is predicted to be higher by some amount from what's maybe observed, depending on who you ask, depending on how significant it is. But you're kind of stuck there that, well, I only have one measurement. If it's down by 2, 3, 4, depending on who you ask, how many sigmas it's down by, is it a problem or not? It's a question of posterior statistics. Okay, and that's this basic dilemma of cosmic variance that, wouldn't it be nice if we could measure the expectation value of the quadrupole instead of just the quadrupole? That'd be much more interesting. And normally that is thought to be difficult to do. That's normal. That's normal thinking, and I think right now there's not really been a lot of ideas of how to overcome this issue. Wouldn't it be nice? How could we measure the expectation value of the quadrupole instead of the quadrupole? Well, there have been a number of, I'm going from what we've shown so far to what I think this we could start thinking about again. There have been a number of papers discussing how you overcome such intrinsic limitations. Okay, and a recent one has been a McDonald and it's been a couple of years ago that. There's been a paper by McDonald and Seljak. The whole goal is to measure a transfer function without going through the statistics of a power spectrum, which is noisy. A simple example of how one might do that, how you might measure the transfer function of structure, is a procedure that, again, it's not done much these days, but actually has been done before. For example, people have not just proposed, but actually have measured peculiar velocity fields by actually measuring velocities from Tully Fisher, for example. Okay. Nowadays, most velocity fields that are published are reconstructed from densities, so it's not a new measurement. But nowadays, when somebody publishes a velocity field, it tends to be from a reconstruction, and then you cannot use that to compare anything anymore. But there have been, over time, measurements of the velocity field directly. And then you can also measure the density field directly. And by comparing the two, you can measure the growth of structure, of how velocity relates to density, without any intrinsic limitation. Okay, so if I could measure the velocity of the quadrupole and the amplitude of the quadrupole, and measure the derivative of the transfer function with no intrinsic cosmic variance. So this is, in principle, something people have proposed over time. And I think it's understood that in principle, what you're saying would be amusing. I don't think anybody has yet shown a practical application given current data, but obviously it's an attractive possibility, to overcome the normal cosmic variance limit of counting modes. And here again, this time works just the same way as a velocity measurement. If you can measure velocity and density field, I think it's clear that you can measure the gravitational strength to any accuracy you want. If you measure the Earth moon system, there's only one moon, but I know its velocity and position really, really well, so I can measure Newton's constant to, it's not the way you don't know the density of the moon, but whatever. You know, you could from a you know, one accurate measurement of multiple variables can measure parameters up in principle arbitrarily precisely. And whether you measure velocity and density or tidal fields is just another form of velocity. And you get in principle a second measurement of the transfer function without cosmic variance. Okay? So here you have another chance of measuring the growth factor and therefore cosmological parameters, perhaps overcoming even otherwise fundamental mode counting limits. So just to look forward of, well, you know, what kinds of things can happen. Obviously, in my simple thing, not only have I ignored edges and whatever, I've only used 10% of the Sloan galaxy. I've only used 100,000 galaxies instead of a million for some rather naive reasons. Like this is one of the subset samples, value-added subset samples of the Sloan that have, they're not fully volume limited, but they're more volume limited, so you don't have, you have a few less things that you have to model out. So I've only really used 10% of the Sloan, the 10% that are easiest to use. They are 10 times more, even in the public data set. Okay, so clearly you can do some amount better by just using all of it. There are many other surveys. Ongoing surveys. They're not future ongoing surveys, like of course BOSS mapped out an even larger volume. More redshifts. I hope everybody here has heard of Chime. Who has not heard of Chime? Chime is the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment, which is a very ambitious redshift survey that was in yesterday's, had a full page spread in the Globe and Mail with a beautiful graphic of a 100 meter telescope being built in Penticton that will survey tens of cubic gigaparsecs. It'll be by far the largest volume redshift survey undertaken. And it's from the same category. It's done by hydrogen intensity, by 21 centimeter intensity mapping. And speaking of just getting very large redshift surveys, we are in the age where there are many, many more surveys coming in. So we will have, this data is coming very rapidly. So I think it is a good time to start thinking about what you could do with more and more data. Obviously, if you're already cosmic variance limited, getting more and more data doesn't do you any good. Like, the CMB quadrupole, at least the way we're doing it now, it's not going to be resolved by having more redshift surveys. It's already cosmic variance limited. So, this is the thing that's ongoing. By measuring more accurately, you could try to, think of more direct ways of going after things like neutrino mass, testing gravity, and all these things, many of which only have small effects on large scales. Okay, so many of these question marks out there are by nature often cosmic variance limited, and here we have potential of measuring the same object more accurately. Good. Well, my conclusion is, I'm arguing here that this cosmic tides is a relatively simple picture to map the gravitational field of dark matter, whatever it is, generates gravity, that is now well understood and well developed and ready to be applied to real data. It is, I think, powerful compared to other techniques to go after it, like gravitational lensing. It seems to work, at least in simulations and to some level in real data. It has potential to go beyond things and to, as you can, I think it opened up also the window of thought of, what is observable and what is not. Thank you. That's on the to-do list. Obviously, includes trying it on mock galaxy surveys, which have the advantage that the Millennium think that's true. But certainly, in if you pick smart simulation, you can keep the mocks in a periodic volume, for example, which is convenient. And at least then all these, at least you can separate out the various things as they break down. Obviously, it's a long to-do list. I'd like to, you know, use more Sloan galaxies as well. You know, the question is it more interesting to try to deal with real data, or more interesting to understand, you know, the intrinsic numerical intrinsic issues?
Well, I would say if you choose first to understand it and then use it, otherwise you don't know what to find.
Well, there are two things, right? One is, will you ever understand the real signal? Okay, if the real signal has just turned out to be so different from anything you simulate, then there's just no point going any further, right? Well, you clearly believe that these mock galaxies actually are related to how the real galaxies get out there, which may or may not be the case. You know, so I would, my first worry was, before we worry, you know, depending on how well you believe these mock galaxies actually describe real galaxies, they may or may not. Okay, they may describe the non-Gaussianity of them perfectly, or they may not. If they don't, then just because it works there does not mean it will work at the next step. So I thought, well, let's just first see. On the real thing, is there a chance of it working? If there isn't, you know, if it turns out that real galaxies, you know, just are so not, so non-Gaussian in some not understood way, then there's just no point, right? Forget about this approach. Yes.
If you can see your formula, you got the integral. Tidal force, what's changing the shape of Earth is the gradient of the gravitational potential. So I expected to see if you have a gravitational map, and then you have gradient of this gravitational map, which is related to the density distribution. So the right side, you have a
you mean this expression?
No.
Okay. So to remind ourselves, what the basic premises of lensing on a Gaussian random field is, you want to look for anisotropies in the statistics of the random field. So you have to build an anisotropic construction that's linear, so a quadratic rather. So taking a gradient of, obviously taking the gradient of a Gaussian random field is still Gaussian random. But it has a direction. And the outer product of two gradients gives you an object with two indices that, if you wish, has, if you think of it as a quadratic object, it's like an ellipse with an alignment. And I want to use the principal axes of this tensor as the next step. So this is just to get principal axes, is to get something which has axes and has the right symmetries, because we know that tides are spin 2, are quadrupolar, and a single gradient doesn't do the job because it's a dipolar symmetry. Taking two of them gives you the right quadrupolar symmetry, which is, we know the symmetry of tidal fields, so this is the most general thing you can do which has the symmetries you need. And the only thing which is kind of skimmed over is what the optimal filter really is, and you can prove in CMB case that this is all you can ever do.